morning. Good morning. Hello. As I look around the room here, I see a couple of people who I'm not going to name who I know have not done any blogs yet, so they've lost 5% already. So make sure that if your name is not on the official list, that it is there, you have to let me know. And make sure you start your work now, because otherwise you're going to lose another 25%, and that's 30% of the unit gone, just because you haven't decided to do anything. So please do that. I'm working through all the blogs and giving the first grade at the moment. There are a couple of administrative things that I want to talk about. I promised I'd give you an extra tutorial, and I'm giving you an extra tutorial today. And we have to decide what time is possible. Hands up those people who could come at 3 o'clock today. How many could come at 3 o'clock today? For what? For what? For what? You didn't hear what I said.
I read the email.
You read the email, but you didn't hear what I said now. Okay. Because you have got an essay due this Friday. And
this Friday.
This Friday.
Oh, my God.
Friday week.
Wait.
Friday off.
It's the 23rd.
It's 2 weeks' time, but not next week, it's the week after.
I gave it a week's extension. Yeah, I gave it a whatever.
I think I almost had a heart attack. We've got another subject due this Friday.
This Friday.
The 20th century ones.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, where were we? What, the 23rd?
23rd.
Yeah. So you've got an extra tutorial that I want to give you. Is 3 o'clock today suitable for everybody? No. Is 4 o'clock today suitable for anybody? No. Is 5 o'clock today suitable for anybody? Two people. How many people can come at 3 o'clock?
Actually, could we just stay here and do the tutorial for this after this?
I don't know if we can. I think there's another class in here. I'm not sure.
I'll just say that means we could then. Because I've got an hour's break.
Well, I've got a tutorial then.
Yeah.
I've got two tutorials immediately after this lecture.
But relating to this group, right?
Yeah.
Well, we're
so
all here.
Yes. I don't think that's possible because there are some people who can't make that first hour. Would it make any difference if the extra tutorial were Wednesday week, which is very close to your essay? Make any difference? No.
I've got like an hour.
Yeah.
Block, which is like
2
till 5.
Yeah. Okay. So for you, neither of that. But would 5 o'clock be possible?
Yeah.
So who could make 5 o'clock? Is that today or next week?
That's every week.
Hands up how many people could make 5 o'clock? 4 people. 5 people. Okay.
Are you going to record?
No. You can record it.
I have to go to work straight after my tutorial.
Like that.
And what time's your tutorial finish?
It's the first.
Right, it's
straight after the.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm in photography 3 to 6.
3 till 6. So a time for you would be 2 till 3.
Yeah.
Who could do 2?
Can we come in earlier next week, like a 9 till 10? Mm. Yeah. Does that work for everyone?
That works for me, yeah.
Works for me.
Who could do 9 to 10 next week?
Yes.
All right, that's it. 9 to 10 next week. Great, we've discovered that. So 9 to 10 next week. So, assume it's in this room. I'll have to check whether this room's free at that time. If it's not, I'll find another room. But assume it's this room and wait outside here next Wednesday. All right? Good? And come with your questions. It's a tutorial where, you know, we're going to deal with your questions, specific things you want to talk about, ask about. The next thing, I'm going to do this in tutorials rather than lectures, but I just wanted to seed your mind with this idea that today I'm going to select, or you're going to select, the drama groups that you're going to be involved in. And it says here, in groups of around seven, that's flexible, choose any aspect of William Blake's life and or works and construct a 10-minute mini-drama that will meaningfully project this aspect of Blake's life and or work to an audience. You may use any technologies that you wish to bring, that you wish to bring this event to life. That means you can use vlogs, videos, whatever. Whatever you want to do. Performances will be presented in the second lecture hour in week 8. And there will be one question in the final exam which will require you to answer this question, and this is the question: how did my work on the Blake Drama Group activity deepen my understanding of William Blake's life and work? And to give you a few examples, I've had students in the past have dramatized one of the scenes from Hell in Marriage of Heaven and Hell, and they put it in a rock and roll pub somewhere in New York. Or they dramatized an argument between Mrs. Blake and William Blake. Or they did a performance of some of the songs of Innocence and Experience. Or they did the scene where William Blake had lost his temper with the soldier who stepped into his garden. Or they did a dramatization of some of William Blake's letters with some of the key ideas in it. So it's up to you, with your group, to choose something that works dramatically, either on stage or on film or in both. Last year had some fantastic utilizations of film and stage at the same time. And you have to think creatively about, well, how you could write about it in the exam, and also how is it going to amplify your knowledge and understanding of William Blake more broadly, which, of course, if you do a good performance and you put good work into it, is bound to help your other work in the unit as a whole. So we'll be talking about that in the tutorials today. So this is just to get your minds thinking about it. Next week we start the first of 3.5 weeks, which incorporates the stand down, which is good. It's deliberately that, like that, on Riders in the Chariot. So that will be the biggest novel that you've ever read in your life. Maybe the hardest novel, maybe not. It's actually brilliant from a whole range of points of view. It's very Australian. It's about Australian ordinary people, but it's got a lot of philosophy in it and a lot of William Blake in it. I will be putting up onto Leo the introduction to Riders in the Chariot that was written by David Malouf. He wrote the introduction for the New York edition of the book about 10 years or so ago, and that's a really good introduction. And David Malouf, of course, is the next novelist that we're dealing with when we finish with Riders in the Chariot. And the reason I've chosen both Patrick White and David Malouf is because they both used quotes from William Blake at the start of their novel in their epigraph. And we want to find out why. And luckily, we've got David Malouf is going to come here and sit with us in this room in week 12 and talk to us about that, why he did. And also what he thinks about Riders in the Chariot, why he wrote an introduction to it. So that should be the high point of your visionary imagination course, to talk to a living author about visionary imagination. And I'm heading today towards that part of Marriage of Heaven and Hell that Patrick White used at the start of his novel. So that's where we're heading today. I hope I get there. Any questions at all? No questions? That's good. So you've had this slide before, so I won't go over that. You've had that slide before, I won't go over that. The fact that you noticed last week in the gallery that Marriage of Heaven and Hell, compared to Book of Job, has no acknowledgement of author or publisher, and this image appeared in the front of one of the Marriage of Heaven and Hell, showed Blake's trepidation at producing something like this in the climate in which he lived. And I talked briefly about this. There's been many different theories about Marriage of Heaven and Hell. Noemi, in the back of our text, his essay on Marriage of Heaven and Hell is very useful. It gives a kind of a grid, his view of how the book is structured. And I'm going to be looking at a few of those elements today. So I want to begin with the fact that this is, again, something I've gone over before, but I want to go over it again in a slightly different way. At various times in Blake's writing, he slyly insinuated how he created his books. And this is how he introduced the Proverbs of Hell in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell on page 71 in your text on plate 6. And you can see it on the screen there. He says, starting down around about here, and you can find it in your text on page 71, when I came home on the abyss of the five senses, where a flat-sided steep frowns over the present world, I saw a mighty devil, here's the mighty devil, folded in black clouds, hovering on the sides of the rock. With corroding fires, he wrote the following sentence, now perceived by the minds of men and read by them on earth. And here's the sentence. How do you know that every bird that cuts the airy way is an immense world of delight closed by your senses five? Well, the mighty devil that's referred to here, the mighty devil, is in fact Blake himself. He is the mighty devil, and he's seeing his own reflection in the bath of acid on the plate that he's producing. And he talks about corrosives, and he adds on page 75 in your text on plate 14, he adds, and we went over this last week, he adds, in hell, the corrosives in hell are salutary and medicinal, melting apparent surfaces away and displaying the infinite which was hid. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. So in this memorable fancy, which is introducing the Proverbs of Hell, Blake is kind of giving a thumbnail sketch of his own creativity and his role in it. And you all know that long after this page was written, the phrase, the doors of perception, was taken up by 20th century novelist Aldous Huxley. He gave that title to his book where he was experimenting with mescaline and its impact on his consciousness. And you may also know about Jim Morrison and the Doors, who took their title from that. So I'm just going to take you there for a second. Let's have a little bit of, let's get into, where is it? A little bit of rock and roll to begin with. The Doors of Perception. Let's, got 2 minutes of the Doors to kind of bring William Blake right into the present. And they're talking here about breaking through to the other side. Can I get it from here or not? Yes, I can get it from here. Am I going to get the speakers from here? Sorry about the...
Your sense of style. Samsung Pure and White. Pure
people. Kill it.
Thank you.
take on to the other side. One wonders what Blake would have thought about that, but certainly his words inspired the Doors in that and many of their other songs. Well, Blake used this method of corrosives to physically embody this metaphor of burning away the surfaces that were hiding the infinite, and that was his idea in his life. And he etched hundreds of copies during his lifetime. And somebody was asking me in the gallery the other day what happened to the metal plates that he used to produce, say, the Job prints or any of these things. Apparently, they were all melted down after they were finished, and especially after Blake died, they're all melted down. There's only one left, and it's that one on the left-hand side. And it was found in 1937. And it's one corner of a plate from his next prophetic book, which is in our anthology, America. And it's done in mirror writing. You can actually find this plate on your page 87 in your text. If you go to page 87, I'd like to... It's at the prophecy at the bottom. The guardian prince of Albion burns in his nightly tent. And you might just see here, I don't know if you can actually see it, in his nightly tent. And then the next line down reads, sullen fires across the Atlantic glow to America's shore. And you've got to America's shore. So he you know, engraved in mirror writing and then put the acid on top of that. Took the acid off pretty quickly so it didn't burn too deep. It's only about 0.2 of a millimetre. The text sits above the metal plate there. And then he used this kind of printing device. You had to press really hard on the paper, put the paper on top and get the print onto the sheet. This weighed about 200 kilos or more. And his wife and he had to move it from various places where they lived in London. He kept that printing press with him till he died. And printing for Blake, as we've talked about before, but this is just a particularly good example. This is also from America, Plate 10. You know, he did his printing so that he could really amplify his writing style with all this, you know, incredible artistry here, which, as we know and as we will discover more, really enhances and amplifies what he's actually saying. So I want to spend a little bit of time now on the theme that's at the core of your essay and that Noemi expands on page 554 in your text, and that is enlarged sense perception. And this really takes place between pages 71 and 75 in your textbook. And we just looked at the very first example of that on page 71 in plate 7, where he writes about being on the abyss of the five senses, where he saw the mighty devil. And where he perceived these lines. How do you know but every bird that cuts the airy way is an immense world of delight closed by your senses five? And that's a very challenging way of perceiving the universe. You know, normally we... don't look twice at birds in the air, and we think that they're a lesser form of creation. But Blake is, and here's an interesting quote I found on this here. Blake teaches us with his words and images to see through the eye and not with it. The birds that chirp and flutter at the periphery of our ordinary consciousness are just generic birds. Not so for Blake, and not so for us if we will open our imagination to his. And this is something that we've seen also in his letters, where he compares normal people's, normal in inverted commas, people's way of looking at the sun and his view, or normal people's way of looking at trees and his view. So, and he talks about the abyss of the five senses, as if the five senses are an abyss in a sense, because if we just stay with the five senses, only with our material perceptions, then we're missing out on some deeper way of seeing. On page 72, he talks about the fool who sees. Where is it? Let me find this here. Second line at the top of page 72. A fool sees not the same tree that a wise man sees. And that sort of picks up exactly what I was just saying. For William Blake, a fool is different from the Shakespearean fool. The fool has a more limited vision than the wise man. On page 73, where he talks about the eagle, this is a line around about line 54. When thou seest an eagle, thou seest a portion of genius. Lift up thy head. It's a way of seeing that is, you know, very close to what those of you doing 20th century literature would have found in Gerard Manley Hopkins. Hopkins's vision of the Windhover, for example, or aspects of nature, have got this, you know, huge amplified sense of life, and ultimately connected with God, connected with the divine. On page 74, there is this plate 11, which I've got here. Here's an illustration of it. You'll see here in these two versions that I've got, the version on the right actually kind of creates the effect of peering at the scene through one of the chinks of the bodily cavern, that's actually like an eye socket almost. And this is a really important part of Blake's description of what went wrong with our seeing since ancient times. He says, the ancient poets animated all sensible objects with gods or geniuses, calling them by the names and adorning them with properties of woods, rivers, mountains, lakes, cities, nations, and whatever their enlarged and numerous senses could perceive. And it's very much like describing what we imagine is the form of perception of indigenous people who still are, you know, connected with their traditional cultures. So ancient poets have a way of seeing beyond simply the materiality of objects. They see through the eye, not with the eye. They animated all sensible objects with gods or geniuses. And the next paragraph goes on, and particularly they studied the genius of each city and country, placing it under its mental deity, till a system was formed, which some took advantage of and enslaved the vulgar by attempting to realize or abstract the mental deities from their objects. Thus began priesthood. Blake was against traditional religion because he felt it was formalizing and narrowing through a rational approach, a sort of instinctive openness to the divine that people had before religions enclosed them within their structures. And he finishes off here, they choosing forms of worship from poetic tales, and at length they pronounced that the gods had ordered such things. Thus men forgot that all deities reside in the human breast. It's a really interesting thought, that is, all deities reside in the human breast. You know, human beings create structures, churches, hierarchies, they need to be told what to do out here. Blake is saying that for him, authentic spirituality is connected with a recognition that the divine is in here, in us. And his work, he is directing us to find our being reality and not to be tied to systems out here, which, so that's really important. Yep.
Understanding
the
plates
you want.
How does he know that all deities reside in the human breast if he didn't follow religion and God?
Well, he did.
Not in the sense that we understand it. How does he know that?
Well, he knows it from his experience. He knows he's speaking from his experience. And while he wasn't trained in formal theology, he did read a lot of mysticism, Jakob Böhme, Paracelsus. He certainly read Corinthians and the Bible. He knew those intimately. Mm. And there's, you know, there's a lot in St. Paul that talks about Christ in me and the inner truth and reality of the divine within the human being. So there's a lot, I think, if you look closely in the in the New Testament, that supports the idea of the divine being an inner, something you discover in yourself. It's only the church and the hierarchy that translated that, first of all, into a Bible that no one could understand, into Latin, because they wanted to maintain control over their over the mystery. Sorry, yep, you wanted to add something?
I read up on that because I wanted to understand how he believed in God.
Yep, good. I thank you for your question, by the way. It's really good to have questions like that. It's really good.
Yes, I read up on that, and he really rejected religion just from small experiences. He kind of delved into it and studied it and looked through all these different sources, all these different people, everything, and then he chose to reject it because he felt that to believe in God, you need to, each person has their own, like, connection.
Yep.
And he, like, felt that the church and the way religion was set out, it was kind of telling these people how to follow this connection.
That's right. I think that also hits
one of the reasons
that I think that's another very important thing you hit on there, and that Blake felt that people in established religions that he saw didn't have that experiential connection, didn't have that connection. You know, maybe their heads were too full of words or too full of theologies. I mean, in a strange sort of way, about 100 years after William Blake, and if we were studying philosophy, we would go there, we would go to Friedrich Nietzsche. And Nietzsche, the German philosopher, said in around about 1879, God is dead. And, you know, that pronouncement sort of echoed, ricocheted through the 20th century. And people have accused Nietzsche of killing God. But what Nietzsche was actually saying, and when you study Nietzsche's ideas in the context of his time, he was saying that God is dead in people's hearts and dead in the churches that he saw around him. There are all these pious people paying money to support bishops and what have you, but there was no authentic Christianity as he could see it. That's why he declared God is dead. And I think there's a, you know, a really interesting link between Blake and Nietzsche. I'm sure someone's done a PhD on it, but if they haven't, there's your chance.
I've read about that, and with that, like, philosophy, they argue how, you know how some people say, oh, I'm, like, they'd say other people are just Christian by name, they don't really follow, but, you know, they go to church every now and then with other religions as well.
Yeah.
That's kind of what that concept is. They don't...
That's right.
If you were to take away the community engagement, take away going, like, attending church and all that stuff, people wouldn't share that connection with God anymore.
That's right, they wouldn't. It's a really whole interesting debate, you know. I mean, what there's two things that come to mind. One is the fact that in all religious traditions, whether it's Christian, Islamic, Hindu or Buddhism, you have what has arisen is called mysticism. In Christianity, it's Christian mysticism, and it's the medieval writers like Meister Eckhart and Jakob Böhme who speak about finding the God within in your experience. In Islam, from what I know about it, Sufism, particularly with people like Rumi, they talk about the inner experience. In Buddhism, it's Zen. In Hinduism, I'm not so sure, but I know that in Hinduism there are methods of mystical meditation that have influenced Christian mysticism. And they're all these mysticisms are deeply interconnected, and they're all about experiencing spirituality in oneself, here and now, which of course gives you community, but it's not enforced by any outer structures. Now, what's interesting is that all those mysticisms are feared by the structures. The established church fears Christian mysticism. They even fear Christian meditation, believe it or not. They fear, the Islamic people fear Sufism and the whirling dervishes. The traditional Buddhists fear Zen. Why is this? It's because people are empowering themselves with their own connection to the divine. And it's, you know, it's sort of taking away from authority. That's the reason for the fear. And that's why Blake had to keep quiet from both political and religious grounds. Now, on page 74, immediately below where you're just looking at, and on the screen here, there's Isaiah and Ezekiel. Now, this passage, the prophets Isaiah and Ezekiel dined with me, this passage is what Patrick White chooses to include at the start of his novel, this whole passage. Now, who were Ezekiel and Isaiah? Now, one thing that's worth just changing the order in which I'd planned to do things, which I always tend to do. Okay, here is the plate that we looked at last week, which is the argument for the beginning of the marriage of heaven and hell. And, you know, we had trouble understanding it, but the imagery is very biblical. Very biblical. And Blake refers us in this, over the next page. He says you've got to read Isaiah 34 and 35. And if you read Isaiah 34 and 35, this introductory poem, and indeed the whole of the purpose of marriage of heaven and hell, becomes much clearer. Let's go there. So here's Isaiah 34. I don't know if you can read it, but you know, maybe you should read it. I'm not going to read it all, but listen. Come near, you nations, to hear, and heed, you people. Let the earth hear, and all that is in it, the world and all things that come forth from it. For the indignation of the Lord is against all nations, and his fury against all their armies. He has utterly destroyed them. He has given them over to the slaughter. Also their slain shall be thrown out. Their stench shall rise from their corpses, and the mountain shall be melted with their blood. All the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled up like a scroll. All their host shall fall down as the leaves fall from the vine and as fruit falling from a fig tree. Now, I'm going to skip across to Isaiah 35. The ransomed shall return. Now, this is where the language of the introduction to Blake's Marriage of Heaven and Hell becomes a little more clearer. The wilderness and the wasteland shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it. They shall see the glory of God, the excellence of our God, etc. Now, I'm not a biblical scholar, and my knowledge of the Old Testament is not much stronger than yours, might even be weaker than some of yours. But it seems to me that the prophets in the Old Testament, the prophets were all eccentric individuals, and they arrived on earth not with any religious mandate, but they came to tell people that the way they were living was not appropriate, and that they needed to change their way of interacting with each other. They needed to wake up to themselves. And if they did, then they could transform the world. And that's, you know, very crudely speaking, my understanding of what a prophet is. A prophet is someone who obviously has some wisdom from a different source than the everyday. Some people would call him mad, psychotic. Others would say that he's got a divine wisdom in him. Yes, please, Sarah.
I was going to say, with the prophets before they, so with the Islamic faith, it's a lot of it is very similar to the Old Testament.
Yep, of course, that's right.
So before these prophets were to send off the message, they all being tested by God.
Yep.
And they do some, like, I guess, things that no other person would be able to handle.
Yep.
They kept their faith in God. And
yep.
That's what made them worthy of passing on this message.
Good.
So that's how they were selected.
But, yeah.
You know, proven to be
yep.
worthy of passing on this
yep.
divine message.
Sounds a little bit like Job, actually. Now, Job wasn't a prophet, but he had what you've just described. In your faith, he is. Is he? That's interesting. That's very interesting. So, but he suffered all that. He went through all that, and he proved that he had the capacity to maintain an open-heartedness to the divine. And therefore, he speaks to us now. Go, Jesse. What? Go say some more.
He was looking at.
I don't know, like Islam.
The names translate different through Arabic, and then when you're translating from Arabic back to English, it's different.
Okay, that's.
However, the prophet that we call as Job is called Ya'ub in Arabic, but it means Job in English.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
What was the name, sorry?
In Arabic, it's called Ya'ub.
How do they spell that,
sorry?
Do you know?
Y O U B.
Y-A-O-U-B. Thank you very much.
That's really good. I hope you do a blog on that. We'll all a blog on the differences between.
Is going to be waiting.
Don't let him down now.
Yeah. So where I'm coming to with this, because I'm trying to tie this into Patrick White, is that Patrick White clearly read these descriptions of Blake's vision of these two prophets. Incidentally, I need to say probably one thing that is important to say, that when you read The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell to begin with seems like a challenge to Swedenborg, and it is a challenge to Swedenborg, because Blake saw Swedenborg to begin with as a prophetic figure. But as Blake got to read Swedenborg more deeply, he saw Swedenborg to be like a sheep in a wolf in sheep's clothing, because he saw Swedenborg as really touting out all the conventional Christian attributes and pretending that they were new. And so this disturbed Blake. And, you know, while the Marriage of Heaven and Hell started off as a satire of Swedenborg, the whole of The Marriage of Heaven and Hell ultimately became much more a satire on all conventional religions and, in fact, conventional politics. So, you know, there is a word that you'll see coming up somewhere here on the screen. Antinomian. I think I've used that word before. Antinomian. You look up that word. The whole of The Marriage of Heaven and Hell is one of the great antinomian works of literature. Antinomian. And antinomian means, if you look it up in the dictionary, it means breaking the law. And Blake was a deliberate lawbreaker in every way, religiously, politically, and so on. So Patrick White, he resonated with what we're going to look at in a minute, resonated very much with what William Blake, how he imagined Isaiah and Ezekiel. And he quoted the whole plate at the start of his novel. And in a nutshell, Isaiah and Ezekiel are presented by Blake as eccentric, radical prophets who are showing the world how to see better. How to see better. and not be so blindfolded. It's all about seeing, and seeing through rather than with the eye. Now, what's particularly interesting in William Blake's case, in Patrick White's case, is that Patrick White saw himself as something of a prophet, and is. And we're going to get to that next week, but I'll give you a heads up here. William Blake wrote an essay called The Prodigal Son. Some of you might have come across it. Any of you done Australian literature with me? Did you remember the essay Prodigal Son? A couple of
John
you do.
White.
Sorry?
Is it John White?
It's Patrick White.
Patrick White.
And the Prodigal Son essay tells us that Patrick White came back to Australia after the war, after he'd been in Greece and what have you, and he looked out across Australia and he saw Australia as a desolate, materialistic land where there wasn't a spiritual bone in anybody's body. I'm exaggerating, but he said something like that. And he said all he wanted to do was go back to Europe. But he decided that he had to stay here because he wanted to try and transform the Australian environment. He felt a duty, and it's a prophetic duty he had, to bring a different consciousness into the Australian scene. And he did. And he got a Nobel Prize for it. The only Australian author who did. And what's amazing is that, you know, in Riders in the Chariot, he selected four of the most down and out or dysfunctional or disrespected people and went into their lives and showed that deep down in their lives there was something miraculous there. The extraordinary in the ordinary. And in fact, Patrick White is one of those many writers who sees those people who live up here as so-called extraordinary people, high politicians, high religious people, etc. They're all fake. And the real reality is down here at the ground level. And Riders in the Chariot is sort of preaching that in a way. If you read Riders in the Chariot carefully and slowly, you'll be overwhelmed by what it actually shows about human beings and their capacities. Now, Patrick White was a poet, really. So every line in his novel is like a poem. So you've got to read it like a poem. You ask Anne-Marie. She's just spent 2 years reading it. She's just come out the end of it. You haven't got 2 years. I'm joking. She didn't spend 2 years. But she spent considerable time. And I was really lucky before the beginning of this semester. I got the flu. And I was in bed for 5 days. And I read it. I've read it 3 times before. But the last time I read it was about 7 years ago. And I thought, I've got to read it again. It took me 5 solid days in bed with cups of tea and coffee and looking out of the window. But it took me 5 days. So I'm just telling you this to gird your loins. Gird your loins. And don't rush it. Don't skip bits. And get it if you haven't got it already. Get it now, today. And read it with a pen, absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Michael, these slides aren't up on me.
No, they're not. No, I just did them this morning. Now, oh yeah, there's something else I've got to do. Okay, look. Look here, please. So this is plate 12 in your book, Memorable Fancy Plate 12, which is on your page 74. Now, this is not the illustration to plate 12, but this is the this is Blake's illustration of Ezekiel's vision. Ezekiel 14 to 28. Ezekiel had a vision of a whirlwind and this amazing four-headed figure coming on a chariot. This is Blake's vision. Why do you think Patrick White called his novel Riders in the Chariot? Tell us, Jess. Speak. Don't play dumb. Speak. What?
Because of
Ezekiel's vision. And it's a vision of riders in a chariot. And each one of those characters in Patrick White, they have a vision. They have this vision. That's what connects them. And so Ezekiel is really kind of at the core of Blake's novel. So let's have a read through this memorable fancy on your page 74. The prophets Isaiah and Ezekiel dined with me. And I asked them how they dared so roundly to assert that God spoke to them. How did they dare to say that God spoke to them? You can't go around saying that God spoke to me. And whether they did not think at the time that they would be misunderstood and so be the cause of imposition, so that they'd be, you know, that they'd be subject to attack or abuse. Isaiah answered, and you can hear Blake talking through this, I saw no God nor heard any in a finite organical perception, but my senses discovered the infinite in everything. And as I was then persuaded and remained confirmed that the voice of honest indignation is the voice of God, I cared not for consequences but wrote. My senses discovered the infinite in everything. I just want to share with you an experience I had on the weekend. I was on a silent retreat and I was given this line, God is the ground of my being. And I was asked to think about it and walk out into this paddock. I thought, this is crazy to have this thought in my mind. God is the ground of my being. What the hell does that mean? What can that mean? There was all this kind of rubbish going on in my head about, you know, how can words connect me with anything? And I just walked down this paddock and I came to this flowering cherry tree. And I stood in front of that flowering cherry tree and I decided I better put my glasses on. I put my glasses on and looked at it. Suddenly it was like this in front of me. And I saw all these bees inside the flowers. It was like I'd never seen a tree before. And what was amazing at that point, I suddenly had the instinct to get down on my knees and lie on the ground. And I did that and immediately I felt all the sense of when I was a child and used to fall down in my grandmother's garden. It all came rushing back into me and I rolled over on my back and I looked up at these blossoms on the tree against a brilliant blue sky. It was just incredible. It was like something in me had kind of switched into a different way of seeing. And the words, the ground of my being, at that moment came back to me. And it really was, the ground of my being was this different connection. And it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't been on that silent retreat, but it was quite amazing. So these lines really do mean something for me. I saw no God nor heard any in a finite organical perception, but my senses discovered the infinite in everything. That Blake asks him another question. Then I asked, does a firm persuasion that a thing is so make it so? Blake's kind of pretending to be the devil's advocate with this Isaiah that he's talking to. Isaiah replied, all poets believe that it does. And in ages of imagination, this firm persuasion removed mountains. But many are not capable of a firm persuasion of anything. Meg is talking here about some kind, yeah, faith. He's talking about faith. He's talking about a deep connection with something, with something in us that we are not normally connected with. I'm talking about myself here. That experience I described is very unusual. Very unusual. And it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't been in those circumstances. Then Ezekiel comes in. Ezekiel was a really crazy prophet. And if you read about Ezekiel in the Bible, he did really mad things. Like he lay down in... Well, that's his vision. But he lay down in cow dung.
Yes.
And ate cow dung. And did weird things that he would have got locked up for. And he's, and Blake asks him, why did you do these things? Let's read on. Then Ezekiel said, the philosophy of the East taught the first principles of human perception. Some nations held one principle for the origin and some another. We of Israel taught that the poetic genius, as you now call it, was the first principle and all the others merely derivative, which was the cause of our despising the priests and philosophers of other countries and prophesying that all gods would at last be proved to originate in ours and to be the tributaries of the poetic genius. It was this that our great poet King David desired so fervently. King David, of course, was a poet, a singer. So King David was someone who was very attuned to the poetic genius. Blake uses the word poetic genius as a sort of a metaphor for the creative imagination that is in all of us, usually locked up, but can become awake. And you know what's really interesting about Blake, to come back to Anne-Marie's question earlier, and you know, this is something that I'm still exploring in Blake. I don't have a profound insight into it, but Blake, in his later work, he actually refers to the imagination as Jesus Christ. And it's as simple as that for him. Jesus Christ becomes a metaphor for the imagination, or is it the other way around? And it's Blake's deep understanding of what Jesus Christ means, which is way far away from anything that the church understands by it. Blake did not want to see Jesus Christ as identified with any kind of saccharine piety. That's why Jesus Christ did not believe in a virgin birth. And if you read the Everlasting Gospel, I pointed this out before, he talks very heretically about the fact that the reason Jesus was called Jesus is because Jesus means forgiveness, and Mary was a woman who had conceived him out of wedlock, and Joseph forgave her, and Joseph is the fruit of that forgiveness. None of this business about virgin birth. That was Blake's take on it. So for Blake, Jesus embodies something that's very human, not something that's up there out of reach. Skip to the top of page 75. I also asked Isaiah, what made him go naked and barefoot for 3 years? They did crazy things. They didn't only expose themselves to the cold, they exposed themselves to injustices and imprisonment and what have you. He answered, the same that made our friend Diogenes the Grecian. And there's a footnote there. You know about Diogenes, I'm sure. Those of you that did 19th century literature with me will remember pointing out Diogenes sitting in a barrel and some young girls mocking him. Diogenes was the Greek philosopher who felt that the real way to understand life and its purpose was to kind of strip yourself of all possessions. And he did that by living in a barrel with only a spoon. Something like that. Something really radical like that. And so Isaiah is here, anachronistically, I would suggest, comparing himself with Diogenes. Why do I say anachronistically? Because Diogenes probably lived after Isaiah. But Blake doesn't worry about things like that. That's not relevant to Blake's point. And then this last one is really interesting, and another big anachronism. I then asked Ezekiel why he ate dung and lay so long on his right and left side. He answered, "The desire of raising other men into a perception of the infinite. This the North American tribes practice." So, the North American tribes, well, Blake's well ahead of his time, but I don't think Ezekiel would have known anything about the North American tribes. But the North American tribes, we know now, are profoundly spiritual people, as spiritual, if not more spiritual, than our own Australian Aboriginals. And I don't know if any of you have read any North American spirituality. Have you read anybody read Black Elk? Black Elk Speaks. Anybody come across that? You should. You know, when you get a chance, have a look at some of the writings. Black Elk Speaks is a particularly good one. Black Elk. He was a tribal leader, and he wrote some wonderful sacred texts about relationships to nature and so on. And you know, the Americans who are into spirituality and so on draw a lot on the American native tradition.
They go into these sort of trances.
Yeah. And well, what he says about what the North American tribes practice is the desire of raising other men into a perception of the infinite. Now, that's exactly what Patrick White does in his novel Riders in the Chariot. He tries to raise his readers into a perception of the infinite. And he does this by taking us deeply, intimately into the lives of these four riders. One of them is an eccentric outcast woman, Molly Hare, who spends most of her time in the bushes doing God knows what. The other person is an Aboriginal, Alf Dubbo, who's not only syphilitic and tuberculosis, but he's on death's door, but he's a brilliant artist. And Patrick White kind of puts his boot in really hard because Alf Dubbo has been brought up by the missionaries and he's been sexually abused by the missionaries and run away from them. The third character is, believe it or not, a professor of English, a German professor of English, who escaped from the Holocaust in Germany, lost his wife, lost his family, lost everything, ended up in Australia. And when he arrived on the customs here in Australia, people looked through his paperwork and they saw that he was an educated man, PhD, professor, etc. And they said, "Well, what sort of job are you looking for?" And he looked down the jobs. He said, "I want a labouring job. This one will do, working in the barren, ugly bicycle lamp factory." And the customs officer said to him, "Well, hang on, why do you want to work there?" And he said, "The intellect has failed us. The intellect has failed us." He was a victim of the Second World War. "The intellect has failed us." So, you know, a profound comment on, well, human society and where do humans need to be. And Mordecai Himmelfarb, because he decides to give up his professorship and work in the bicycle lamp factory in that wonderfully named Australian suburb Barron Ugly, which is somewhere out in the western suburbs, I think it's next to Blacktown, isn't it, Barron Ugly, he works there, and because he works there, he meets Alf Dubbo, who also works there part-time sweeping the floors. They meet in the men's toilet. And in the men's toilet, Alf Dubbo finds... I can't remember now whether it's Alf Dubbo who finds Himmelfarb's Bible or Himmelfarb finds Alf Dubbo's Bible. I can't remember. Can you remember, Anne-Marie? Which Bible it is found? Who owns the Bible?
It's...
Alf Dubbo's Bible?
I think it is Alf Dubbo's Bible, and Himmelfarb sees it and notices that Alf Dubbo's been reading from Ezekiel. What's this? So there's this amazing sort of connection that occurs between these two characters. And the last woman is Mrs. Godbold, who's a washerwoman, and whose husband's an alcoholic. And she goes and rescues Alf Dubbo from the local brothel. So, you know, they talk about Christ having spent his time with prostitutes and tax gatherers and people in brothels, etc. That part of the story is never really referred to very much in so-called Christianity. But, you know, Christ was down with the down and outs and part of that world. And you know, Blake and Patrick White and others recognize this, as does David Malouf in Remembering Babylon. That also focuses on an outcast and his importance.
When I was in God's Court, we used to yep. say that Jesus Christ is the friend of the outcast.
Yeah, beautiful. That's exactly right.
Michael,
yep.
is Rise in the Chariot set in the
50s? I beg your pardon?
Is Rise in the Chariot set in the 50s?
Yeah, it's around about the 50s or the 60s. I think it was, when was it published? I think it was published... around about 1960, yeah. So, well, it's obviously after the Second World War. So it's probably set, you know, 50. Probably 50. Because in fact, you know, Mordecai Himmelfarb arrives in Australia at the start of the novel. So, about 1950. So that... Oh, the last line here on plate 12, plate 13 it actually becomes, the desire of raising other men into perception of the infinite, this the North American tribes practice, and is he honest who resists his genius or conscience only for the sake of present ease or gratification? This is Ezekiel talking. Is he honest who resists his genius or conscience? It's really important, that is, that, and it applies to everybody, especially me. You know, we all gravitate to present ease and gratification. That's the human condition. We all want to just lie on the floor and roll in the muck. That's the human condition. Some of you are going to disagree with that. But basically, we are all lazy. All of us. I'm not looking at anybody, I'm looking at myself. I could look at a few people, but I won't. Present ease or gratification. So Ezekiel says, is he honest who resists his genius or conscience? Genius or conscience. What could that mean? What could it mean? What could our genius and our conscience mean? For each of us, what could it mean? Do you have a sense in your own life as to where your energies ought to be directed on a daily basis? Yep.
I don't know, I feel like people have a calling or something inside them which tells them what they're supposed to do with their life, and that's not always the easiest thing to do.
Yep.
Accepted.
Good. And it's not always heard. You know, quite often it's covered over. Quite often it takes some sort of trigger to make you see it. Yes, Alex?
Could it also mean like we're in a state of denial?
In a state of denial, that's right. We know about it, but we turn our face from it. We don't want to go there. Good. So genius or conscience, that part in all of us which tries to speak to us but often can't get through to us. the doors of perception. We've talked enough about the doors of perception. But at the bottom of this plate 14, on your page 75, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. For man has closed himself up till he sees all things through narrow chinks of his cavern. Well, that really describes what we've just been talking about. That we are closed up and we see things only through the narrow chink of our cavern. And the footnote in your text refers to Plato's story about the cave in the Republic. And in Plato's cave, Plato describes all human beings as like prisoners in a cave. And there's a roadway behind, and there's a fire, and the fire is reflecting their shadows in front of them. And the exit to the daylight is here, but we never get to the daylight. We're kind of trapped looking at our own shadows. Plato, this metaphor of Plato's is very, very famous and has been used by philosophers for 2,000 years as a picture of the human condition, Plato's cave. And Blake is clearly alluding to it here, that we are trapped. For William Blake, it was the metaphor of sleep. You know, William Blake, we introduced Blake 5 weeks ago now by saying that William Blake, in the beginning of Jerusalem, says that we are all asleep and we need to wake up. That's the condition. And how true is it? I mean, you know, I've said this to you before, but if you look at the contents of your brain right now, you know, maybe 7% of you is listening to my words and thinking, what a load of bullshit. And, you know, 93% is mixed up of, you know, when's this bloody lecture going to finish? What am I going to have for lunch? What's my girlfriend thinking? Is that argument I had last night going to work itself out? What's my car? Are my car tires all right? On and on and on. And then there'll be an argument you had with a friend 12 months ago. And then there's the fact you haven't seen your mother for 4 years. On and on and on and on. And I tell you, that's me. That's me. They're my stories. What are yours? What are yours? We are asleep. We are stuck. We are glued to videos that are going on the whole time. All these different videos going on all the time. How can we be free of that? How can we find a space, a chink, where we can see an immense world of delight in a bird that flies past us? How can we? Well, I had my chink on the weekend. I described it to you. It was a chink. It was, definitely. And I know in some of your blogs you've described some similar things. There have been some wonderful blogs coming out with people describing moments of vision. So I want to talk a little bit about this amazing title page for Marriage of Heaven and Hell. In this book, which celebrates hell, Blake has in mind something very different from the usual connotations of the word hell. The fundamental idea in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell is that theologians and preachers have wrongly stigmatized energy as diabolical, even though energy is essential to existence. These preachers and theologians, they claim, and this is Blake's quote on plate 3 in your book on page 69, they claim that good is the passive that obeys reason, evil is the active springing from energy. That's what theologians and preachers say. Good is the passive that obeys reason. Evil is the active energy.
So that's not his view.
No, that's the view of preachers and theologians.
That makes sense now.
I know.
Now, Blake's counterclaim is that heaven and hell must interact as vital contraries. Like partners in a marriage, maybe, who are different and yet they're joined. Both are equally important. Though in the marriage of heaven and hell, in this polemical story, hell gets the better of the argument. That's in a nutshell, what the marriage of heaven and hell is about. On page 69, you can read the whole thing there in that second paragraph on page 69. Without contraries is no progression. Attraction and repulsion, reason and energy, love and hate are necessary to human existence. From these contraries spring what the religious call good and evil. Good is the passive that obeys reason. Evil is the active springing from energy. This is why Blake was so against the denial of the body that was part of fundamental traditional Christianity as he saw it, and why he loved to paint nakedness in all its forms. Now, there is this wonderful description of this plate by the first biographer of William Blake, Alexander Gilchrist. You can still buy the biography. It's in an everyman text. And this is the description that Gilchrist gives to this painting. And the painting really, in many ways, magnificently embodies the whole of this text. If you understand what this painting is, you'll understand the whole of this text. Interestingly, you've got two figures embracing here, very sensually described. One is a satanic figure coming out of the flames, and the other one is a so-called morally good figure lying on a white cloud here, and they're embracing, but what you might not notice is they're both women. Blake's sexuality was very androgynous, and increased so during his life. So that's an interesting aspect. And this is what how Gilchrist beautifully describes this image. The ever-fluctuating colour, the spectral pygmies rolling, flying, leaping among the letters, the ripe bloom of quiet corners, the living light and bursts of flame, the spires and tongues of fire vibrating with the full prism make the page seem to move and quiver within its boundaries. And you'll notice that at the top there is a rather demure couple strolling along, and there's a... You've actually got this now. Let me just point this out to you as well, because it's interesting to compare your version with this. This is on your colour plate 7 in your text. If you go there, you'll see some of the figures a little less energetically presented, but perhaps a little more clearly. Your plate 7, which is just before your page 199. There's also, you'll see there, a woman reclining against a tree while her suitor is maybe reading to her or perhaps playing a musical instrument. The trees above them are drooping and leafless, but from below, energy is surging up powerfully from down here. Energy is surging up powerfully. And you've got this naked pair of figures embracing down in the front. You might call this an antinomian devil, a law-breaking devil perhaps. And maybe this is an orthodox angel resting on a white cloud. The cloud looks, you can see it very clearly in your version. And their union is repeated in all these couples flying up above them. It's interesting the twisting in this couple here. They're not embracing like an ordinary couple. There's a real twist. Maybe they're locked in a kiss. Their bodies are extending and twisting in opposite directions.
Being pulled apart.
Almost like being pulled apart, perhaps. Yeah, something like that. Interesting. The marriage is not a marriage of identity. And gender is not necessarily the basis. Both figures, as I've said, seem to be female, and that's perhaps more clear in your copy than the one I've got on the screen here. But you'll notice that the devil on the left is definitely more voluptuous. There's a real sensuality in Blake's depiction. Now, a recurring theme in Blake's work is that the symbols that he's using express what go on in our minds. And I don't know if any of you noticed this, but you can see that this is actually the shape of a human head. You've got the nose here, the mouth here, the eyes up here. The whole thing, if you look at it, and you can see it maybe more clearly on your page, the whole thing is the shape of a human head. The trees are outlining its hairy scalp. The courting couples are its eyes. And the circle around the word and is its mouth. So our world, as we normally perceive it, lies above the line here. The world that we normally perceive lies above that line. And beneath that burns the energy that makes life possible. And both worlds, heaven and hell, exist within human consciousness. Flaming energy is one aspect of vital existence. How are we doing for time? There's another image on colour plate 13, which you don't have the image of this, but you do have part of plate 13. Where is it? The plate is actually on your page 79. It doesn't fit with your page, but there it is on page 79. Here is another colour version of it. Sorry, there it is there. This is the only version, this particular one. If you go to the Blake archive and to the Marriage of Heaven and Hell, you will find this in copy D. It's the only copy where they've got pyramids in the background. Copy D. And it's the illustration to it's actually an illustration to plate 21. So your page 79, I've just noticed up here. You can't see it on the screen here, but it's actually got 21 there. So it is actually located in the right place. What have we got here? We've got a naked young man with his genitals very piously exposed. And there's a skull under his knee. And you've got the skull under his knee on your drawing on page 79. And what does this image evoke? Maybe it suggests that revolution abolishes bondage to dead ancestors. And you know, this whole sequence, the Marriage of Heaven and Hell, is about political revolution as well as spiritual revolution. And here are a few quotes that are worth looking at, and this is actually from your previous Norton anthology in the 19th century, which has a whole section on the French Revolution, and it quotes from Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine, and it's worth having a look at how this kind of political context relates to what's happening in the marriage of heaven and hell. Edmund Burke, who was a very right-wing politician, philosopher at the time, a great advocate of George III, was horrified by the French Revolution, and he argued that society is a contract that mustn't be altered. He wrote, "As the ends of such a partnership cannot be obtained in many generations, it becomes a partnership between those who are living, those who are dead, and those who are to be born." This was Edmund Burke's fear of the French Revolution and its implications, consequence, coming to England. Thomas Paine, who Blake knew, who wrote The Rights of Man, he was a friend also of Mary Wollstonecraft, who wrote The Rights of Woman. And Thomas Paine sensibly left England and went to live in America at this time. He knew that if he'd be caught, he'd probably be executed. Thomas Paine retorted to Edmund Burke's Rights of Man and said, "Mr. Burke is contending for the authority of the dead over the rights and freedom of the living. Government is for the living and not for the dead." And one of Blake's proverbs of hell expressed his own response to this quite clearly. "Drive your cart and your plough over the bones of the dead." That was Blake's view of we need to live in the now, we need to live in the present and not be tied to the past. So we've looked at the doctrine of contraries. We've looked at that, which really Nurmi suggests takes up plates 1 to 6. Let's have a little look at the Proverbs of Hell. These proverbs are really anti-proverbs in a way. They're very confusing when you read them. Ordinary proverbs convey conventional truisms. For instance, somebody might say, "Absence makes the heart grow fonder," or "out of sight, out of mind." But Blake's proverbs or aphorisms are anything but conventional. They kind of challenge us to rethink our point of view. "Exuberance is beauty." "The cistern contains, the fountain overflows." "The tigers of wrath are wiser than the horses of instruction." "The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom." Is that true or is it not true? Now, you're not going to believe this, but Donald Trump, is it Donald Trump in America? His block of flats sits on the edge of Central Park in New York. And you wouldn't believe this, but in the downstairs window of his apartment, he has got quoted there, "The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom," William Blake. And he's using William Blake's quote as a kind of a support for his own maniacal, egotistic drive for presidency. Is that what Blake intended in the Proverbs of Hell? Or has Blake put that there as something that we've got to kind of sit back and think about? Yes, Jess?
It's like if you have something of excess, you start to realize that you need what's essential. So it's like when you don't have anything, you realize what you do need.
Yeah.
If you do have everything, you're able to narrow down what you actually do. So
that's a very interesting way of looking at it. I don't think Trump would have thought that at all. Would he? That's not Trump's interpretation.
It makes him feel better, though, by putting that.
It makes him feel better, that's right. It's amazing. Those of us going to New York must go and look that out. He might be president by then. It's a bit frightening, isn't it?
I really hope that. Did you see the photo of the wall that they built around his Hollywood Walk of Fame star, because he kept talking about building a huge wall on the border of Mexico, and so
right.
People did.
Yeah, that's right.
He built like a tiny wall around his little star. Yeah. It's good.
Very good. Somebody had some insight and vision there. one of the Proverbs of Hell, which is near the start of your Proverbs of Hell, is eternity is in love with the productions of time. Eternity is in love with the productions of time. Now, I like this one particularly. It connects up with the lines that I've referred to many times from Auguries of Innocence: to see a world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wild flower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. So there's this wonderful quote here from, it's a bit dark actually on there. Not, and it's a bit light, I mean, I'm going to just change it. Hang on a second, I'll just... better now. Jacob Burme, this comes back to what I was saying to Anne-Marie earlier about Blake's interest in mysticism. In one of Blake's letters, he refers to Burme and Paracelsus. He also talks about Milton and Shakespeare. And this is a little quote from Jacob Burme, which gives a little hint of where Blake gets his mystical thinking from. Burme said, "When I take up a stone or clod of earth and look upon it, then I see that which is above and that which is below. Yea, I see the whole world therein." Reminds me of Hopkins as well as Thomas Traherne, the Renaissance poet. Poets are often talking about the fact that to see the smallest item, to see it in a completely different perspective, to find the extraordinary in the ordinary. And Blake saying eternity is in love with the productions of time, is, as I interpret it, is that the things that are created around us, the things that are part of our environment, they have embodied eternity if we make ourselves available to see it. I think I've nearly come to the end of everything I wanted to say today. We looked a little bit at the Song of Liberty earlier on, the way that the Song of Liberty, some people were questioning, or it has been questioned, whether it's actually part of the marriage of heaven and hell. It is clearly a political statement about Blake's response to George III and his intention to declare war against France. And, you know, it's perhaps the most politically obvious part of the whole of the marriage of heaven and hell. And this is where I want to stop with that quote, which, you know, for me summarizes the essence of what Blake is asking us to find and trying to represent for us about our way of seeing. It would enable us to see a bird as an immense world of delight, closed by our mere five senses. So I'll see you in tutorials, and we will first of all break up into established groups for working on this Blake drama performance. And those of you that came in late, we've agreed that we're going to have a special extra tutorial on Marriage of Heaven and Hell, Brett Whiteley and Job, next Wednesday at 9 o'clock, and it'll be here. That's where we'll meet anyway. If this class is taken, I'll find another room. Yep.
How long does it go for?
How long does it go for? The lecture starts at 10, so we've got an hour. I'm happy to start at 8:30 if you want to.
A-Y-O-U-B.
Beg your pardon?
What's spelled? A-Y-O-U-B, not
Y-A-O-U-B.
Thank
you very much.
Are you being rude again, David?
No.
Good.
It was the Islam.
Oh, good. Okay, I was trying to decipher your anagram. I'm thinking, what's he up to? What is David up to?
You never know what David
is
up to.
Can I ask for Pope 12?
Yep.
Blake spells persuasion with a W.
Yeah, his spelling is quite idiosyncratic. He spelt just the way he felt, and at that time, spelling was not as rigidly defined as it is nowadays.
So was it a way of, because he was doing it from perspective of the devil?
Yeah,
was
I don't think. I don't think so. I don't think so. I think it was just his way of spelling persuasion. But if you look up in the Blake Index, you might find there that he spelled it a different way. But my first thought is no. He couldn't spell. No, that's right.
The word peace. P-I-E-C-E.
That's right. He should have been thrown out of primary class.
Maybe when he was in the moment, the spelling wasn't.
That's right.
I hope it makes a lot of sense now that you say that it's the
church good.
That said.
Thank God I said it then, eh?
Oh, yeah. Because there's a full stop there, and I thought that's what Blake is thinking.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. I will put all those slides up. I will put them all on the web. I didn't do them today because I only just did them. Anne Marie, what timeline have I got on this? A week. I'll give it back next week. I'll give it you back next week and I'll make it. Yep. No, I won't forget. I won't take it out of my office.
Do you know the definition
of the books that you put in the library?
Yeah, enclosed reserve.
Enclosed reserve. So I got.
They're all there.
If I go up to the
desk and ask them, there, but you can actually see them when you're at the front desk. They're on the far right-hand side in the bottom shelf in front of you.
And I ask for the English bridge line.
Good, mate.
Correct.
Yeah. Did you get to
back to the library? Yeah, I've been quite back.
It would have been a great day the day you were there.
Oh, it's great. People. No, not really. Yeah, actually, you should go back because they turned up
there.
What did they turn up?
They turned up the documentary.
Oh, yeah. So
I've seen really the most of the ones on YouTube there.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was great. It's good to just have, I've
spent
a lot of the quotes as well.
Yeah.
I still haven't decided which panel I'm doing. I'm going to have to go back again. So I'm happy to go back again.
I really don't have time. I'm time poor at the moment.
Where do you live?
Elwood.
You have your
transfer. I have my car, but I've just sold. Well, I haven't sold my car.
I saw the new car. I saw it.
It's nice, isn't it? It
looks beautiful.
It's very nice. Leather interior.
Oh boy.
Wood grain.
Talk about self-indulgence.
Well, it was just a good price.
Yeah.
And it's just the right height for me to sit.
Fantastic. That's good.
Because it's not as high as the van.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's not as low as a car. Yeah. It's just the right height. So.
Well, when I was sitting upstairs on Whiteley's black couch, and one of the guys came past and told me to look up Bob Dylan's press interview. Exactly where I was.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
I was just like, it was fantastic.
Bob Dylan was.
Yeah, Bob Dylan was sitting exactly where I was sitting on that couch.
What year would that have been?
I think, mid-70s.
Wow, always
fun. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. That's the original couch.
Do you know what Dylan's doing now?
No.
He's a radio announcer.
Oh, really?
You're kidding. No. What's he? Is he any good?
Apparently so. Yeah.
I was never a huge fan.
It's a good commentary of the commentator of rock music.
Yeah.
I was never a huge fan of
Dylan.
I was. And then, but I love the Beatles. They're my favorite.
No. They're my favourite too.
Really?
Well, on the 28th of August, 1964, the Beatles were in the same hotel as Bob Dylan. So Bob Dylan sent for them.
But you weren't born then. How do you know this? I was in boarding school then. I remember the Beatles in August 1964. I remember them well.
Yeah.
My mother was at the airport screaming and waving.
Oh, I would have loved to be there. I was so
see you in the tutorial.
Yes.
Very soon.
Yes.